How do you reconcile the storyteller's desire to touch the mystic chords of memory, as Lincoln put it, with the need for objectivity and factual accuracy in your documentaries?
Well, I'm not sure the mystic chords of memory are necessarily at odds with an objective history. I think it's important to remember at the outset that any historical activity, whether it's novelistic or scholarly, is itself subjective. It's taking facts and it's presenting them in a certain order, or in the case of fiction, it's altering those facts. So subjectivity exists at every level, and that's a very important thing to understand. It then becomes the question of how you use the material. And of course, those in an academic environment are governed by a certain set of rules. Those in an environment of fiction, say on the other extreme, are governed by their own sets of rules. Those of us in a more popular form of historical presentation have our own sets of rules and influences. And it really just becomes, at the end of the day, not whether you're objective, but whether you have, in my case, arranged the truths artfully so that one could, through their artful arrangement, create something that suggested a higher purpose. And I think that's where Lincoln's mystic chords of memory come in. It's what we're all looking for, is that which harmonizes. Remember, his chords are not C-O-R-D-S chords that bind, but they're C-H-O-R-D-S, as if there might be some musical, some celestial harmony that human beings could be attuned to.
So at the basis of what you're saying is, I guess, a fundamental belief that life can make sense if it's looked at steadily enough.
Yes, I think that we certainly live in an age, and I'm sure every age has felt this, where the randomness of events, both good and bad, suggest a world without pattern. But I think it is, in fact, the province of religion, of knowledge, which would include history, of art, of science, to try to find the pattern and try to find the order. And I think in my own small little way, that's what we're trying to do, how to digest, in the case of something like the Civil War or baseball or jazz, the main parts of my trilogy, which I'm going to talk about this evening, some order in the affairs of human beings, in the tides of historical fortune, in how people conduct themselves individually. So all of these things become grist for a mill that we're trying to sort of fashion something new out of.
Do you ever catch yourself imposing rather than discovering a pattern?
The work is, in fact, this, I think, a wonderful tension between the desire to impose. And in this case, what is it that you're imposing? Essentially, some variation on Aristotelian poetics, trying to find out of the stuff of life a beginning, a middle, and an end, how to endow human beings who may not be yielding up to, as Stephen Vincent Benet said, the picklocks of biographers, much information about themselves, but you nevertheless are trying to find character development in them, another part of Aristotelian poetics. So yes, I'm working with that on a daily basis, imposing. But I think the style that we've set up for ourselves, which is quite different from many of our contemporaries, who commission a script after a research period and then basically film the script and edit that, we are not in the business of telling you what we already know, but sharing with you our process of discovery. And that allows, of course, the second thing to happen, which is for the material to speak.
So your audience is involved with you in the storytelling process?
Yes, I think it's not, they're not making it. I had to do that. We're not yielding the act of storytelling, but we're saying to you, you know, this is a good story. I mean, I was reading an intellectual biography of Emerson called Mind on Fire, and at one point the young Emerson discovers in his study the Greek word, roots of the word enthusiasm, which mean God in us. Mm-hmm. So I think what we've just tried to do is enthusiastically tell our stories, not from a position of telling you what we know, but sharing with you what we are in the process of discovering. And in fact, our research period goes on from the moment we begin a project to the day it's over. our writing period takes place from the beginning of the project. We shoot from the beginning to the end, where it makes it a much more cumbersome process, but one that I think yields up a combination of free electrons, if you will, that permit other people to participate in our in the joy of our process, and I think to some extent create a half-life for these projects that are the reason why they survive.
So it's not as clear to see the pre-production, production, post-production phases in your work as it might be in more conventional types of filmmaking.
Well, there are conventional types of filmmaking, as Hollywood will tell you, they call it the industry or the business, right? Well, I'm not in the industry. I'm not in the business. I'm not making a widget. I'm not stamping out a product. I'm curious about the most traumatic event in the life of our country, the Civil War. I'm interested in the only art form Americans have created, jazz. I'm interested in our so-called national pastime, how it got to be where it is. So these are questions that exist on an emotional and an intellectual level, and the byproduct of my exercise of those parts of myself and a great physical demand is the creation of these films that exist sort of partly in the marketplace and partly outside of the marketplace.
Many contemporary historians believe that traditional histories focus too much on individual greatness. A lot of your work centers on stories of extraordinary individuals. Do you think the idea of individual greatness has a place in American democracy? And if so, what is that place?
I think individual greatness has a central place. I think those academic historians who are leery of biography, which Thomas Carlyle said is biography, and certainly, as you point out, the constituent building blocks of my work are biographies, and in some cases the entire work is a biography of someone, and looking to greatness to give example. The Academy is quite right to be frightened of biography, because I think in the wrong hands it does tend towards what we call hagiography or hero worship, and it becomes a kind of dangerous thing in which we see all of historical phenomena as being a product of the exercise of an individual or individual's will. That doesn't happen. Individuals are in turn shaped by forces, and they do in cases shape forces. But we are ourselves human beings. The word history is mostly made up of the word story. And we are inevitably drawn to the processes of history by the act of telling stories. And the thing that human beings are most interested in are other human beings. So necessarily, one realizes that one of the agencies of historical communication, particularly in a broad popular sense, is through biography, is through the life of people. You have to be mindful of hagiography. And in point of fact, I haven't come across any biography of a great person in which I felt that they were probably not as great as the person made them out to be, no matter how reasonable they were able to make their faults. And I think the difference between the truth of their life, whatever that is, and this biography is what we wish for ourselves. And so history isn't just being perfectly factual for the Academy to make a point about other forces, but in fact a kind of public discourse and communication in which we re-remind ourselves what it is we wish to be. So Lincoln is never as great as we make him out to be. The difference between what he actually was and what we keep saying is what we wish for ourselves. When we say we hope that something the whole will be greater than the sum of the parts, we never actually examine what we're saying, that we want to add up the sum of the parts and then add up the whole, and we never ask ourselves, what's the difference? What is that more? Well, I'm interested in that more, and I'm interested in pointing towards it. So Lincoln isn't as great as we make him out to be. He's almost as great, and the difference is what we wish for ourselves. We wish ourselves to be greater.
Those cautions are entirely reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
Why are they so difficult to sell in the Academy, would you say?
Well, I think the Academy, remember, has gone through lots of different fashions. For a while, it was relevance, which ruined history altogether. Then it was semiotics and deconstruction. Then there's different gender studies, and all sorts of fashions come in and out. It is true that for the last 50 years or so, narrative and biography have been the enemy. But in point of fact, the Academy has only been defining what history is for the last 100 years. Before that, history was a very vast, broad human enterprise. And our most popular historians were popular writers. Our most important historians were popular writers who were concerned with reaching people. The Academy has abdicated the reaching of people in the pursuit of history, and that has been to the detriment not only of the Academy, that is to say, developing a kind of myopia and a conservatism, believe it or not, in their toleration of views and the ability to encompass many points of view, which is paradoxically what my superficial medium of film is able to do in A Civil War, in which you treat it as a complex family drama. But they've also failed the populace, which needs to be informed. It has to be told its histories. And, you know, perhaps television is our new Homeric form in which we sort of sing our epic verses around an electronic campfire, but a campfire nonetheless in which you're sharing it with people.
That leads very easily and naturally to my next question. Do you think American education is doing a good job of preparing its citizens for democracy?
It is not in any way. In fact, American education has almost abdicated its responsibility in the creation of citizens. And if they don't do it, I don't know who will besides parents. And parents are often themselves ill-equipped.
Why do you think that's happened, and what do you think the remedies might be?
Well, it's happened for a couple of reasons. One, the teachers aren't very good. They're not committed to teaching people, and schools have become largely warehouses for child care. Second, television, the thing that I do, is the most corrosive and dangerous medium that we have yet invented, and it has the terrible aspect of corroding our national attention. I mean, people watch television for many, many hours a day, and it's not so much that they're devoting their attention to something. The problem is they're not devoting their attention. They look at something for 6 or 8 minutes, and then they're interrupted and sold 6 to 8 things. There's no way you can develop attention. And attention is, in fact, what delivers you to information, what delivers you to knowledge, that permits you to synthesize different points of view and to remember things. So we've turned ourselves into vast consuming entities that are told that if we just buy the right car, if we wear the right jeans, if we smell the right way, everything will be all right. Well, anybody has to look up today and find out it's not going to be all right. And that kind of danger, our schools are completely abdicating. You know, I was taught in the late 50s and 60s in elementary school, and it was fantastic education, probably the best on earth. When the Trent Lott affair happened a few months ago, my daughter attends Yale University. She's a junior. My youngest daughter is in a private school. I asked them if they'd ever heard of Jefferson Davis. They said, of course, Daddy, from you. But in their entire extremely expensive education, no one had ever taught them who Jefferson Davis was.
This is a failure, then, not only of public education, but of the way Americans think about education?
Absolutely.
Or the way education is on the national radar as a priority, would you say?
Well, I think it's everybody's priority, but we have abdicated our society to those who are the most powerful consumers. And that seems to be a group that would like to set the agenda, the 18 to 35 or whatever, and they're not interested in that. And so everyone, corporations, politicians, as well as teachers and parents, abdicate in the face of this tremendous buying power, which will one day prove to be not as important as having an informed and literate and thinking citizen.
Is there any way to reconcile late-stage global capitalism with a genuine concern for social public policy?
Just people, individual people, trying to make a difference. And that goes back to, you know, whether people can do something or not. I yell about it all the time. And, you know, if you get one kid to get interested in the Civil War and find out where we were from, then that's one kid better.
Much of your work then is implicitly about education.
Right.
Have you thought about doing a documentary on education, on the story of education in America?
No. It's just like people come and approach me with the idea of doing a film on the Constitution, the writing of the Constitution. I say, I don't want to make a film whose images are all green felt tables and white quill pens coming out of inkwells. Nobody likes that. That's boring.
Right.
But I've made a film about the Constitution in every film I've done.
Right.
It oozes out of every pore, between the lines. And that's how real education comes, is indirectly. And when we sort of focus on it and say, this is what the problem is, we've got to do that, you end up not really having as great a response as if, you know, it's the whole adage, you know, you've got to teach a person to fish, not just hand them the fish.
And in a way, you have to make sure abstractions emerge from particulars.
Absolutely, and they always do. And that's the interesting thing, that quite often, if you take an essayistic or didactic approach to a subject, you often lose the very glue that makes that subject stick in the minds of the initiate. But if you focus on story and individuals, you often are then able to bring along these very complex themes. There's no person who could look at my Civil War series and complain that it is not chock-a-block with important themes. It's just that those people who eschew narrative and eschew biography somehow see it just a priori flawed because it's that approach, forgetting that all of the things that they rail about are in fact in there.
One more question for you. In your commencement address to the 1987 graduates of Hampshire College, you said, quote, avoid the word career and even profession. They are concerned with money and position. Continue to investigate, end quote. To what extent do you think the course of your own life's work has enabled you to follow that advice?
Well, that advice was given to me by Robert Penn Warren, who said, careerism is death. And I have, since he told me that in the early 1980s, eschewed the use of the word career unless I was speaking about the very topic you and I are now speaking about. And when I refer to career, it's in a pejorative sense. Profession, no. I've had a professional life. But I believe those words as strongly now, if not more strongly, than before. You have to do, as Emerson said, whatever in Lee rejoices, he said in the essay on self-reliance. And that's doesn't necessarily mean following some career path. I mean, my career path is to have left after the Civil War to Hollywood to make films. But we're now 13 years past the broadcast of the Civil War, and I'm no closer to Hollywood, thank the Lord.
And still inly rejoicing?
And still inly rejoicing, you bet.
Good.
Thank you.
Can I move next door?
Yeah. Terrific.
Thanks very much.
That's
real pleasure.
That's the best set of questions I've had in I don't know how long. Very, very, very good.
Thank you. Yeah. Looking forward to your talk tonight.
Great.